Hi, thanks. It's nice to be here today. I'll be giving an overview of observational properties of BE star disks with an emphasis on resolving the disks at high spatial resolution. So I'll start off by giving a general overview on how before we were able to resolve the disk, we knew that there were disks around BE stars. And then I'll go over some results from high spatial resolution studies that focus on measuring the geometry and size of the disks, the multi-wavelength structure, kinematics, and asymmetric structures within the disks of BE stars. And so BE stars are characterized by their H-alpha emission. And so this is just a schematic of a BE star with a rapidly rotating star in the center and a disk around it. And the morphology that you see of the H-alpha emission lines will depend on your viewing angle of the disk. If you're looking at it edge-on, you'll see the nice double-peaked profile. If you're looking at it pole-on from above in this diagram, you'll see narrow emission lines. And you also get evidence of the disk from infrared excesses. And so over here you have the 11 micron excess compared with the 2 micron excess. And the BE stars are located all over here. And so fitting an SED to the infrared excesses allows you to determine that the gas emission is generated from free-free emission from the circumstellar gas. And this is just spectrophotometric data that shows in the visible over on this side. If you match that up to the stellar spectrum, the stellar spectrum is here, and you have a nice infrared axis over here from the disk. You can also infer the presence of disks from the linear polarization. So this is a paper that by McLean and Brown that looked at 67 BE stars. And the distribution of the linear polarization with respect to the rotational velocity of the star allows you to infer that the circumstellar gas is not spherically symmetric. This is a more recent study that adds more data to this diagram. And so you have a peak in the linear polarization of about 2%. And the polarization drops off at very small and very large rotational velocities of the star. And this basically, you can infer that the drop-off at large rotational velocities is due to a, when you're rotational velocities, you get a thinner disk, which is the cause of the drop-off. And I think Carol Jones will be talking more about the polarization studies of BE stars later on this afternoon. And so I'll focus now on spatially resolved observations of circumstellar disks around BE stars. And so this is just a sampling of some of the interferometers that have been used to study BE stars. The Char Array at Mount Wilson, which is where I work. And we can combine the light in both the near-infrared and the visible bands. And we have baselines ranging from like 30 meters out to 300 meters. There's also PTI, that, which is now decommissioned, which operated also in the near-infrared wavelengths. There's the Navy Precision Optical Interferometer in Flagstaff, Arizona. And they have capabilities of resolving H-alpha emission. And then there's VLTI at Paranal, which can do HNK imaging there too. And so just as a basic overview of interferometry, so you have the basic two telescope interferometer here. And the light that hits one telescope will arrive sooner, so there's an extra path length on of the starlight that hits this telescope. And so you add a fixed path length in your beam combination lab, and when the path lengths are equal, you get out the interference fringe pattern. The spatial resolution is given by the wavelength divided by the baseline. And so for a 300 meter baseline operating in the H band, you can get down to resolutions of about half a milliarc seconds. So this is kind of an ideal resolution for being able to resolve the spatial distribution of circumstellar gas around the brightest BE stars. And so this is basically just an overview of the interferometric observables. And so when you get the fringe pattern, there's two measurements you can make. One is the amplitude of the fringes, which we call the visibility. Encoded in the visibilities are the size and geometry of the light distribution that you're looking at. So for a unresolved point source, you'll have maximum fringe amplitude. And as you resolve the star, the light from the resolved surface will incoherently combine, so you have a drop in the fringe visibility. So the more resolved your structure is, the smaller the fringes will get. And then you can also measure the phase of the fringe pattern. And for the phases, in optical and infrared, optical and near-infrared interferometry, is corrupted by the atmosphere. So you work in terms of either differential phases, where you're looking at, say, the phase across emission lines compared with the continuum, or closure phases, where you can combine certain telescopes together. And the phase information basically gives you information about asymmetries in the light distribution. And so this is basically just a schematic of if you have a light distribution and you have a baseline that's sampling along, say, the major axis of ellipse, you get a visibility curve that basically drops off as you go to longer and longer baselines. So your longer baselines, the fringe visibility will decrease because you have better resolution of the object. If you sample the distribution along the minor axis, it's less resolved, so you get a visibility curve that drops off less steeply. And so one of the first papers that was presented resolved observation of BE star disk was Kieran Back in 1994 using the Mark III interferometer, which is no longer in existence. It used to be up at Mount Wilson also. And this is a very preliminary image reconstruction that was presented in the paper for Zeta Tau. And so basically, the optical interferometry was able to confirm that the circumstellar gas is indeed contained in a flattened disk. And also that the position angle of the major axis derived from the interferometry agrees with the orientation of the disk derived from the linear polarization results. And so there's different models that you can fit to the interferometric visibilities. And so the most common geometric model that is used is just to assume that the central star itself is a uniformly bright circular disk. And then the circumstellar material can be characterized by an elliptical Gaussian component that drops off. And so you can also, not only can you fit geometric models, you can also fit, say, viscous decretion disk models, and we'll hear about more about these models and their fits to the data in talks this afternoon. And you can also, in cases where you have very good baseline coverage on the sky, you can actually attempt to do image reconstruction. So this this is an image. These are all images of gamma casts. These two are both in the H band. This is in the K band. And so these two were derived from the same data. And so the MACIM image reconstruction was image reconstruction software generated by Mike Ireland. And so basically here, you input basically just some kind of initial light distribution, and then the routine moves around the flux to find a best fit. So basically, the only things were fixed in this is that I assumed that there was a point source, a uniform disk star in the middle with an angular diameter of 0.4 milliarc seconds. And then I put in just a circular Gaussian, and it was able to reproduce the orientation of the disk without any knowledge at all, just moving the flux around. And so this is it's tricky to do the image reconstructions on the BE stars because the disks are very low surface brightness, but you you can at least attempt some reconstructions though. So this is the data that went into these models of the of gamma casts. So over here we have the baseline coverage of the telescopes projected onto the sky. So we were working with five telescopes in this data. So we actually had 10 different combinations of baselines. And this is the visibility curve for gamma casts. So again, at long baselines, you see there's a jump in the visibility. But this is basically just these higher visibilities are sampling the shorter axis of the disk, while the more resolved visibilities are sampling the larger axis. And so the black data points are the data, and the red is the elliptical Gaussian model. And so we were able to derive like a major axis of about 1 milliarcsecond with a position angle of 26%. That's 26 degrees. And so I'll take a brief moment to talk about these closure phases. And so the closure phases here, as I mentioned before, the atmosphere corrupts the phase information from the fringes at optical and infrared wavelengths. And so we can form this closure phase quantity. And that basically, if you have, like, say, a patch of air that adds a phase error to one of the telescopes, if you combine the light, combine the phases appropriately in a closed triangle, you can remove the atmospheric contribution. And so basically, the closure phases are sensitive to asymmetries in the light distribution. And so a point symmetric object will either have 0 or 180-degree closure phases, and if you have anything between there, there's some asymmetry in the light distribution. So this is just basically looking at that data from gamma casts again, and because we did have five telescopes, we were able to look at the closure phases. And so this is the closure phases here. The dotted line here marks the 0 degree closure phase, and most of the visibilities, most of the closure phases are less than 0 degrees here. And so in the previous models, I just had basically a circular star. And so here, I basically shaded off the edge that maybe is shaded by the disk. And you get this nice, a much better fit to these closure phases. And there's a, you can actually tell which side of the disk is faded. So you know the absolute orientation of the disk, whether it's towards you or away from you, which was kind of a neat result to fall out of there. There's still a lot of variation, which could be additional asymmetries in the disk or like detection of binary companion. We're currently looking into what the additional variation over here is. Okay, so back to the sizes of BE star disks. Different interferometers will work at different wavelengths. So this is just basically comparing the sizes measured in the H-alpha emission lines compared with K-prime continuums. And so the K-band continuum diameter is over here, and the H-alpha is over here. And so for a sample of stars were observed at both wavelengths, the H-alpha sizes of the disk are consistently larger than the K-band diameters. And so this is can result from differences in the opacity in H-alpha compared with the K-band continuum. And you can also look at continuum sizes at different wavelengths also. And so this is work by Yamina Tuhami, and the magenta line here is basically an isothermo decretion disk model for zeta tau. And fitting to the interferometric data, you can get the density structure of the disk. And so basically here you have two near-infrared observations at H and K band. And over here you have two mid-infrared wavelength contributions. And so overall the sizes drop off at smaller wavelengths. And so this can indicate the density structure of the disks. And so this is, we have a survey going on with the Chiral array. that we're measuring, trying to measure a sample of stars at both K-band and H-band to compare these continuum sizes at different wavelengths. And so here we have the K-band, and this is the H-band continuum. And so in all cases, as expected from the decretion models, that the stars are consistently larger in the longer wavelengths than compared to shorter wavelengths. And we're starting to extend this down to the R-band continuum also. And so this is using the Pavo beam combiner, which combines light in the R and I bands at the char array. And so we have somewhat noisier visibilities in here, but we have nice coverage out at long wavelengths. We don't have very good coverage on the sky, so we had to fix a few things, like we fixed the position angle of the disk and the axis ratio between the major and minor axis based on the infrared models. But the visible light observations can also probe the size of the star itself. So you can get a measurement not only of the size of the star, but also of the disk. And this is a little bit more complicated because there's a degeneracy between the sizes of the star and the size of the disk and the flux ratio. So ideally what we want to do is actually fit the spectral information in addition to the visibilities to get a better handle on what the contributions actually are. And so this is just for gamma cast, a sample of these continuum sizes with K-band, H-band, and then two R-band measurements, one I believe with the Vega beam combiner at the char array. And so this here is combining the R-band data now is currently a work in progress. Okay, and so now I'll move briefly to looking at the kinematics of the disk from interferometry. And yesterday, John gave a good overview of this, so you'll see some of the same figures here. So you can get kinematic information if you actually look at the spectrally dispersed interferometry. And so basically over here is the spectrally dispersed visibilities. I think this is alpha era. And so you get the double peaked profile in the visibilities. And so there's a drop in the visibilities across the H alpha line. And the drop in visibilities indicates that, as we saw before, that the H alpha emission is more resolved compared to the continuum emission over here. You also, in the differential phases, you get these S-curve profiles. And these S-curve profiles is basically just a shift of the photocenter. So if you're looking on the blue-sided velocities, you'll be looking at the side of the disk off-centered from the star that's moving towards you. And on the red-shifted side, you're looking there's a shift in the photocenter because you're looking at the portion of the disk that's moving away from you. So this is basically just a result of Keplerian rotation. And so you can generate these kinematic models where you have a velocity map and an intensity distribution. And given this is basically what it looks like in just a narrow emission line channel. And so based on the work of Mylan et al., that looked at a sample of 8 BE stars, they determined that the rotation is close to Keplerian rotation, and the stars are rotating about 82% of critical rotation. And I thought I'd also point out that these kinematic models can also give you, since the disks are in Keplerian rotation, is also a way to probe the stellar mass of the central star. If you know both the velocity structure of the disk, and you're also spatially resolving the size of that emission. Okay, and so now I'll move on to looking at asymmetries in the disks of BE stars. And so over here is basically just for zeta tau, variations in the H alpha profile. And so you get these V over R variations, which compare the violet and the violet and the red sides of the H alpha emission, and the strength of those two sides of the emission lines will vary over time. And The timescales for this variability are on the order of days to decades. And an interpretation of this is these one-armed global oscillation models, where you have a density enhancement of the disk. And then depending on the viewing angle, you'll get, if you're viewing it from down here, you have the density enhancement on the side of the disk that's rotating towards you, so you get an enhancement on the blue side of the H-alpha profile. And so you can see this in the interferometry. This is our differential visibility. It's taken with the VLTI AMBER instrument. And you can see these are the differential visibilities over on this side, and these are the phases. And these S-curves are not symmetric, so which indicates there's more emission coming from this side of the disk compared with the other side. And you can then fit these global oscillation models to the visibilities and generate models that describe this. So these are basically velocity slices through the disk, and this is the integrated intensity overall. And this is just a face-on view of what the oscillation pattern looks like on the sky, or face-on. So in addition to the differential phases, you can also look at these closure phase properties. And so we, for zeta tau, we looked at H-band continuum with the Merck combiner at Chara. And we detect the non-zero closure phase properties, which again, the phase indicates like asymmetries in the light distribution. So instead of now the previous results over here, we're in the bracket gamma emission line. And you could also just do this work in the H-alpha emission line. And now here, we're just in the continuum emission. So that we're actually, that we see also a, it's not a, a velocity dependent asymmetries. This is just the broadband continuum emission. And so we were able to model this asymmetry in the light distribution by taking just our elliptical Gaussian model and modulating it by a sine wave so that the brightness peaks on one side and drops down on the other. So kind of a very crude form of this global oscillation model. So in this model here, this backside over here of the disk is brighter compared to this side over here. And that provides a nice fit to the closure phase data that we measure. And so we actually measured this over, we have a long-term program to try to see if we can see changes in the disks of the BE stars over time. And so these are all images of zeta tau. And we get an average of major axis of about 1.6 milliarc seconds, and that the disk in the H band contributes, the star contributes 55%, so the disk contributes 45% of the light. And so the disk contribution is a little less in the K band, in the H band compared with the K band. And you see the motion of the asymmetry. So here is like kind of this half of the disk, and it moves off to the side. And then on this one down here is down on the lower side. And, another striking observation that we made from these observations was that it seemed like the position angle of the disk was changing over time. And as far as we can tell, that we think this is possibly a real change in position angle. And so we started thinking about, well, what could cause this change in position angle? And so we started looking at how it relates to these VO over R variations in the H-alpha emission. So over here is this periodic V over R oscillations here. And the times of our observations happen kind of just over in this part. So if you zoom in, these are the four epochs that we saw. And so we basically linked up the our observations and previous observations in the literature with this phase determined from this period in the V over R oscillations of about 1,400 days. And so if you do that, they plot the H alpha phase over the position angle of the disk. So these are our measurements plus measurements in the literature. We saw what could be an oscillation, so that or a sinusoidal oscillation. This is just doubled up twice the phase. And so we had a mean position angle of about 58 degrees with a semi-amplitude of about 8 degrees. So the disk could potentially be maybe precessing around. The mean position angle that we measure agrees quite nicely with that derived from linear polarization, but they don't see this variation in the position angle in the linear polarization. So if this oscillation is indeed present, that would mean that, like, because the linear polarization could be probing structures in the inner part of the disk, whereas the long baseline interferometry would be possibly probing structures on the outer part of the disk, which might be more sensitive to torques, possibly from the binary companion. So this is basically just a toy model we generated that could possibly explain, like, this precession of the disk. And this is basically the location of the density and enhancement in the disk. And so if you match this up with our observations, they kind of match, like, this general this generally toy model with the structure that we see in the interferometry. So somewhat speculative, but potentially something interesting here. And so I just leave that up there, and then I think I'm finishing a little early, but there's my summary. So basically, the long baseline optical interferometry can help you probe the geometry, size, and density structure of the BE star disks, and also let you generate kinematic models and investigate asymmetries from global oscillation models. I think the model that we did had prograde precession, but I'm not sure if we tested both scenarios. That's something we can look into. Yeah.
I interpret this as that the phase is not zero in the continuum.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
When you show differential phase, almost all plots show zero phase in the continuum. And you show the S across the line. Does that have any impact on your analysis across the line?
Yeah, so partly, I think, like, a lot of the BE stars that we've looked at with Merck that has closure phases, a lot of the closure phases are actually very close to zero. Zeta tau was our special case where it was a strong non-zero closure phase signature. We do see, say, in like phi per and a few other BE stars with binaries, yeah, you could actually see periodic oscillations. But again, those are all very small amplitude. It's just a few degrees around it. So it's going to affect at some point the continuum measurements. But I think the asymmetries through the spectral lines are going to be stronger than the asymmetries we're detecting here. I think I guess the asymmetry we detect here for zeta tau is about 5 degrees. So it'll provide some bias. I'm not sure how it'll...
It just seems we have... I mean, it's great work. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. It just seems we have a little bit of inconsistency. And on top of that, closure phases, the way you close the triangle, they tend to make the phases look smaller than they actually are.
Okay.
The triangle has tendency to cancel them out. So you actually have a...
potentially a longer.
Phase, the continuum phase could be actually even longer.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I guess it's not.
In another way, have you attempted to model the differential phases with a non-zero continuum phase, even though you would have to assume it?
Yeah, that might be something to look into.
I think Anthony would like to.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
By definition, the differential phase is zero in the continuum because it's how it's defined.
No, this is how it's measured, but when you're modeling, you're making assumptions.
It has no natural zero point. Only the closure phase has a natural zero point.
So differential phase is the real phase minus the real phase in the continuum, in fact. So it's always zero in the continuum. So even if you model an asymmetric object, the differential phase would be zero in the continuum, but the differential phase shift, this S shift, will be asymmetric. And we see clearly in some Ambert data or some Vega data that we have this asymmetric. And mainly on the stars where we have global dissociation arm. So this can be taken into account in models. And for some stars, we did that. The data from Kappa CMA, the data from Zitato also is zero for the differential phase. But you used also the closure phase.
So if I hear this correctly, you're not forcing the phase to be zero.
No, that's the definition of the differential phase. That's like sometimes you also see differential visibility, which are set to one in the continuum. That doesn't mean the visibility is one in the continuum. That means that you're just telling the variation through the line.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, I think John,
you have a
question?
Yeah, just a comment that in the models for zeta tau, which has a slight inclination.
Yeah.
When you have the spiral density wave, the brightness distribution, when it's on the spirals on the backside of the star, the density distribution is slightly above. And so as it comes around, it drops back and forth across the major axis. And that should produce the slight oscillation in the apparent position angle of the disk.
Yeah.
Any more questions? Okay, if not, we might as well move along and thank Gail again.